percent share for inheritance is slightly higher than the inheritance flow expressed as a percentage of national income, 20 to 25% in the 19th century. This is because income from capital, generally about a third of national income, is de facto reassigned in part to inheritance, and in part to earned income. For cohorts born in the 1870s and after, the share of inheritance in total resources begins to decline gradually. This is because a growing share of these individuals should have inherited after World War I, and therefore received less than expected owing to the shocks to their parents' assets. The lowest point was reached by cohorts born in 1910 to 1920. These individuals should have inherited in the years between the end of World War II and 1960, that is, at a time when the inheritance flow had reached its lowest level, so that inheritance accounted for only 8 to 10% of total resources. The rebound began with cohorts born in 1930 to 1950, who inherited in 1970 to 1990, and for whom inheritance accounted for 12 to 14% of total resources. But it is above all for cohorts born in 1970 to 1980, who began to receive gifts and bequests in 2000 to 2010. That inheritance regained an importance not seen since the 19th century, around 22 to 24% of total resources. These figures show clearly that we have only just emerged from the end of inheritance era, and they also show how differently different cohorts born in the 20th century experienced the relative importance of savings and inheritance. The baby boom cohorts had to make it on their own, almost as much as the interwar and turn-of-the-century cohorts, who were devastated by war. By contrast, the cohorts born in the last third of the century experienced the powerful influence of inherited wealth to almost the same degree as the cohorts of the 19th and 21st centuries. Rastignac's dilemma. Thus far, I have examined only averages. One of the principal characteristics of inherited wealth, however, is that it is distributed in a highly inegalitarian fashion. By introducing into the previous estimates inequality of inheritance on the one hand and inequality of earned income on the other, we will at last be able to analyze the degree to which Vautrin's somber lesson was true in different periods. PDF figure 11.10 shows that the cohorts born in the late 18th century and throughout the 19th century, including Eugène de Rastignac's cohort, Balzac tells us that he was born in 1798, did indeed face the terrible dilemma described by the ex-convict. Those who could somehow lay hands on inherited wealth were able to live far better than those obliged to make their way by study and work. In order to make it possible to interpret the different levels of resources as concretely and intuitively as possible, I have expressed resources in terms of multiples of the average income of the least well-paid 50% of workers in each period. We may take this baseline as the standard of living of the lower class, which generally claimed about half of national income in this period. This is a useful reference point for judging inequality in a society. The principal results obtained are the following. In the 19th century, the lifetime resources available to the wealthiest 1% of heirs, that is, the individuals inheriting the top 1% of legacies in their generation, were 25 to 30 times greater than the resources of the lower class. In other words, a person who could obtain such an inheritance, either from parents or via a spouse, could afford to pay a staff of 25 to 30 domestic servants throughout his life. At the same time, the resources afforded by the top 1% of earned incomes, in jobs such as judge, prosecutor, or attorney, as in Vautrin's lecture, were about 10 times the resources of the lower class. This was not negligible, but it was clearly a much lower standard of living, especially since, as Vautrin observed, such jobs were not easy to obtain. It was not enough to do brilliantly in law school, Often one had to plot and scheme for many long years with no guarantee of success. Under such conditions, if the opportunity to lay hands on an inheritance in the top centile presented itself, it was surely better not to pass it up. At the very least, it was worth a moment's reflection. If we now do the same calculation for the generations born in 1910 to 1920, we find that they faced different life choices. The top 1% of inheritances afforded resources that were barely 5 times the lower class standard. The best paid 1% of jobs still afforded 10 to 12 times that standard, as a consequence of the fact that the top centile of the wage hierarchy was relatively stable at about 6 to 7% of total wages over a long period. For the first time in history, no doubt, one could live better by obtaining a job in the top centile rather than an inheritance in the top centile. Study, work, and talent paid better than inheritance. The choice was almost as clear for the baby boom cohorts. A Rastignac born in 1940 to 1950 had every reason to aim for a job in the top centile, which afforded resources 10 to 12 times greater than the lower class standard, and to ignore the Vautrins of the day, since the top centile of inheritances brought in just 6 to 7 times the lower class standard. For all these generations, success through work was more profitable, and not just more moral. Concretely, these results also indicate that throughout this period, and for all the cohorts born between 1910 and 1960, the top centile of the income hierarchy consisted largely of people whose primary source of income was work. This was a major change, not only because it was a historical first in France and most likely in all other European countries, but also because the top centile is an extremely important group in every society. As noted in Chapter 7, the top centile is a relatively broad elite that plays a central role in shaping the economic, political, and symbolic structure of society. In all traditional societies, remember that the aristocracy represented 1 to 2% of the population in 1789, and in fact down to the Belle Époque, despite the hopes kindled by the French Revolution, this group was always dominated by inherited capital. The fact that this was not the case for the cohorts born in the first half of the 20th century was therefore a major event, which fostered unprecedented faith in the irreversibility of social progress and the end of the old social order. To be sure, inequality was not eradicated in the 3 decades after World War II, but it was viewed primarily from the optimistic angle of wage inequalities. To be sure, there were significant differences between blue-collar workers, white-collar workers, and managers, and these disparities tended to grow wider in France in the 1950s. But there was a fundamental unity to this society, in which everyone participated in the communion of labor and honored the meritocratic ideal. People believed that the arbitrary inequalities of inherited wealth were a thing of the past. For the cohorts born in the 1970s, and even more for those born later, things are quite different. In particular, life choices have become more complex. The inherited wealth of the top centile counts for about as much as the employment of the top centile, or even slightly more, 12 to 13 times the lower class standard of living for inheritance versus 10 to 11 times for earned income. Note, however, that the structure of inequality and of the top centile today is also quite different from what it was in the 19th century, because inherited wealth is significantly less concentrated today than in the past. Today's cohorts face a unique set of inequalities and social structures, which are in a sense somewhere between the world cynically described by Vautrin, in which inheritance predominated over labor, and the enchanted world of the post-war decades, in which labor predominated over inheritance. According to our findings, the top centile of the social hierarchy in France today are likely to derive their income about equally from inherited wealth and their own labor. The basic arithmetic of rentiers and managers. To recapitulate, a society in which income from inherited capital predominates over income from labor at the summit of the social hierarchy, that is, a society like those described by Balzac and Austen, two conditions must be satisfied. First, the capital stock and, within it, the share of inherited capital must be large. Typically, the capital-income ratio must be on the order of 6 or 7, and most of the capital stock must consist of inherited capital. In such a society, inherited wealth can account for about a quarter of the average resources available to each cohort, or even as much as a third if one assumes a high degree of inequality in returns on capital. This was the case in the 18th and 19th centuries, until 1914. This first condition, which concerns the stock of inherited wealth, is once again close to being satisfied today. The second condition is that inherited wealth must be extremely concentrated. If inherited wealth were distributed in the same way as income from labor, with identical levels for the top decile, top centile, etc., of the hierarchies of both inheritance and labor income, then Vautrin's world could never exist. Income from labor would always far outweigh income from inherited wealth, by a factor of at least 3. And the top 1% of earned incomes would systematically and mechanically outweigh the top 1% of incomes from inherited capital. In order for the concentration effect to dominate the volume effect, the top centile of the inheritance hierarchy must by itself claim the lion's share of inherited wealth. This was indeed the case in the 18th and 19th centuries, when the top centile owned 50-60% of total wealth, or as much as 70% in Britain or Belle Époque Paris, which is nearly 10 times greater than the top centile's share of earned income, about 6-7%, a figure that remained stable over a very long period of time. This 10-to-1 ratio between wealth and salary concentrations is enough to counterbalance the 3-to-1 volume ratio and explains why an inherited fortune in the top centile enabled a person to live practically 3 times better than an employment in the top centile in the patrimonial society of the 19th century. See PDF figure 11.10. This basic arithmetic of rentier and managers also helps us to understand why the top centiles of inherited wealth and earned income are almost balanced in France today. The concentration of wealth is about 3 times greater than the concentration of earned income. The top centile owns 20% of total wealth, while the top centile of earners claims 6-7% of total wages. So the concentration effect roughly balances the volume effect. We can also see why heirs were so clearly dominated by managers during the Trente Glorieuses. The 3-to-1 concentration effect was too small to balance the 10-to-1 mass effect. Apart from these situations, which are the result of extreme shocks and specific public policies, especially tax policies, however, the natural structure of inequality seems rather to favor a domination of rentiers over managers. In particular, when growth is low and the return on capital is distinctly greater than the growth rate, it is almost inevitable, at least in the most plausible dynamic models, that wealth will become so concentrated that top incomes from capital will predominate over top incomes from labor by a wide margin. The classic patrimonial society, the world of Balzac and Austen. 19th-century novelists obviously did not use the same categories we do to describe the social structures of their time, but they depicted the same deep structures, those of a society in which a truly comfortable life required the possession of a large fortune. It is striking to see how similar the inegalitarian structures, orders of magnitude, and amounts minutely specified by Balzac and Austen were on both sides of the English Channel, despite the differences in currency, literary style, and plot. As noted in Chapter 2, monetary markers were extremely stable in the inflation-free world described by both novelists, so that they were able to specify precisely how large an income, or fortune, one needed to rise above mediocrity and live with a minimum of elegance. For both writers, the material and psychological threshold was about 30 times the average income of the day. Below that level, a Balzacian or Austenian hero found it difficult to live a dignified life. It was quite possible to cross that threshold if one was among the wealthiest 1%, and even better if one approached the top 0.5 or even 0.1% of French or British society in the 19th century. This was a well-defined and fairly numerous social group, a minority, to be sure, but a large enough minority to define the structure of society and sustain a novelistic universe. But it was totally out of reach for anyone content to practice a profession, no matter how well it paid. The best-paid 1% of professions did not allow one to come anywhere near this standard of living, nor did the best-paid 0.1%. In most of these novels, the financial, social, and psychological setting is established in the first few pages, and occasionally alluded to thereafter, so that the reader will not forget everything that sets the characters of the novel apart from the rest of society. The monetary markers that shape their lives, their rivalries, their strategies, and their hopes. In Père Goriot, the old man's fall from grace is conveyed at once by the fact that he has been obliged to make do with the filthiest room in the Vauquer boarding house and survive on the skimpiest of meals in order to reduce his annual expenditure to 500 francs, or roughly the average annual income at the time, abject poverty for Balzac. The old man sacrificed everything for his daughters, each of whom received a dowry of 500,000 francs, or an annual rent of 25,000 francs, about 50 times the average income. In Balzac's novels, this is the basic unit of fortune, the symbol of true wealth and elegant living. The contrast between the two extremes of society is thus established at the outset. Nevertheless, Balzac does not forget that between abject poverty and true wealth, all sorts of intermediate situations exist, some more mediocre than others. The small Rastignac estate near Angoulême yields barely 3,000 francs a year, or six times the average income. For Balzac, this is typical of the moneyless, lesser nobility of the provinces. Eugène's family can spare only 1,200 francs a year to pay for his law studies in the capital. In Vautrin's lecture, the annual salary of 5,000 francs, or 10 times average income, that young Rastignac could potentially earn as a royal prosecutor after much effort and with great uncertainty, is the very symbol of mediocrity. Proof, if proof were needed, that study leads nowhere. Balzac depicts a society in which the minimum objective is to obtain 20 to 30 times the average income of the day, or even 50 times, as Delphine and Anastasie are able to do thanks to their dowries, or better yet, 100 times, thanks to the 50,000 francs in annual rent that Mademoiselle Victorine's million will earn. In César Birotteau, the audacious perfumer also covets a fortune of 1,000,000 francs, so that he can keep half for himself and his wife, while using the other half as a dowry for his daughter, which is what he believes it will take for her to marry well, and allow his future son-in-law to purchase the practice of the notary Roguin. His wife, who would prefer to return to the land, tries to convince him that they can retire on an annual rent of 2,000 francs and marry their daughter with only 8,000 francs of rent, but César will not hear of it. He does not want to wind up like his associate, Pillerault, who retired with just 5,000 francs of rent. To live well, he needs 20 to 30 times the average income. With only 5 to 10 times the average, one barely survives. We find precisely the same orders of magnitude on the other side of the channel. In Sense and Sensibility, the kernel of the plot, financial as well as psychological, is established in the first 10 pages in the appalling dialogue between John Dashwood and his wife, Fanny. John has just inherited the vast Norland estate, which brings in 4,000 pounds a year, or more than 100 times the average income of the day, which was barely more than 30 pounds a year in 1800 to 1810. Norland is the quintessential example of a very large landed estate, the pinnacle of wealth in Jane Austen's novels. With 2,000 pounds a year, or more than 60 times the average income, Colonel Brandon and his Delaford estate are well within expectations for a great landowner. In other novels, we discover that £1,000 a year is quite sufficient for an Austenian hero. By contrast, £600 a year, 20 times average income, is just enough to leave John Willoughby at the lower limit of a comfortable existence. And people wonder how the handsome and impetuous young man can live so large on so little. This is no doubt the reason why he soon abandons Marion, distraught and inconsolable, for Miss Grey and her dowry of £50,000, £2,500 in annual rent, or 80 times average income, which is almost exactly the same size as Mademoiselle Victorine's dowry of 1,000,000 francs under prevailing exchange rates. As in Balzac, a dowry half that size, such as Delphine's or Anastasie's, is perfectly satisfactory. For example, Miss Morton, the only daughter of Lord Norton, has a capital of £30,000, £1,500 of rent, or 50 times average income, which makes her the ideal heiress and the quarry of every prospective mother-in-law, starting with Mrs. Ferrers, who has no difficulty imagining the girl married to her son Edward. From the opening pages, John Dashwood's opulence is contrasted with the comparative poverty of his half-sisters, Eleanor, Marianne, and Margaret, who, along with their mother, must get by on £500 a year, or £125 apiece, barely four times the average per capita income, which is woefully inadequate for the girls to find suitable husbands. Mrs. Jennings, who revels in the social gossip of the Devonshire countryside, likes to remind them of this during the many balls, courtesy calls, and musical evenings that fill their days, and frequently bring them into contact with young and attractive suitors, who unfortunately do not always tarry. The smallness of your fortune may make him hang back. As in Balzac's novels, so too in Jane Austen's. Only a very modest life is possible with just 5 or 10 times the average income. Incomes close to or below the average of £30 a year are not even mentioned. Moreover, this, one suspects, is not much above the level of the servants, so there is no point in talking about it. When Edward Ferrers thinks of becoming a pastor and accepting the parish of Delaford with its living of £200 a year, between 6 and 7 times the average, he is nearly taken for a saint. Even though he supplements his living with the income from the small sum left him by his family as punishment for his mésalliance, and with the meager income that Eleanor brings, the couple will not go very far, and they were neither of them quite enough in love to think that £350 a year would supply them with the comforts of life. This happy and virtuous outcome should not be allowed to hide the essence of the matter. By accepting the advice of the odious Fanny, and refusing to aid his half-sisters, or to share one iota of his immense fortune, despite the promises he made to his father on his deathbed, John Dashwood forces Eleanor and Marion to live mediocre and humiliating lives. Their fate is entirely sealed by the appalling dialogue at the beginning of the book. Toward the end of the 19th century, the same type of inegalitarian financial arrangement could also be found in the United States. In Washington Square, a novel published by Henry James in 1881 and magnificently translated to the screen in William Wyler's film The Heiress, 1949, the plot revolves entirely around confusion as to the amount of a dowry. But arithmetic is merciless, and it is best not to make a mistake, as Catherine Sloper discovers when her fiancé flees on learning that her dowry will bring him only $10,000 a year in rent, rather than the $30,000 he was counting on, or just 20 times the average U.S. income of the time, instead of 60. "You are too ugly," her tyrannical, extremely rich widower father tells her, in a manner reminiscent of Prince Bolkonski with Princess Marie in War and Peace. Men can also find themselves in very fragile positions. In The Magnificent Ambersons, Orson Welles shows us the downfall of an arrogant heir, George, who at one point has enjoyed an annual income of $60,000, 120 times the average, before falling victim in the early 1900s to the automobile revolution and ending up with a job that pays a below-average $350 a year. Extreme inequality of wealth. A condition of civilization in a poor society? Interestingly, 19th-century novelists were not content simply to describe precisely the income and wealth hierarchies that existed in their time. They often give a very concrete and intimate account of how people lived and what different levels of income meant in terms of the realities of everyday life. Sometimes this went along with a certain justification of extreme inequality of wealth, in the sense that one can read between the lines an argument that without such inequality, it would have been impossible for a very small elite to concern themselves with something other than subsistence. Extreme inequality is almost a condition of civilization. In particular, Jane Austen minutely describes daily life in the early 19th century. She tells us what it cost to eat, to buy furniture and clothing, and to travel about. And indeed, in the absence of modern technology, everything is very costly and takes time, and above all, staff. Servants are needed to gather and prepare food, which cannot easily be preserved. Clothing costs money. Even the most minimal fancy dress might cost several months or even years' income. Travel was also expensive. It required horses, carriages, servants to take care of them, feed for the animals, and so on. The reader is made to see that life would have been objectively quite difficult for a person with only 3 to 5 times the average income, because it would then have been necessary to spend most of one's time attending to the needs of daily life. If you wanted books, or musical instruments, or jewelry, or ball gowns, then there was no choice but to have an income 20 to 30 times the average of the day. In Part 1, I noted that it was difficult and simplistic to compare purchasing power over long periods of time, because consumption patterns and prices change radically in so many dimensions that no single index can capture the reality. Nevertheless, according to official indices, the average per capita purchasing power in Britain and France in 1800 was about 1/10 what it was in 2010. In other words, with 20 or 30 times the average income in 1800, a person would probably have lived no better than with 2 or 3 times the average income today. With 5 to 10 times the average income in 1800, one would have been in a situation somewhere between the minimum and average wage today. In any case, a Balzacian or Austenian character would have used the services of dozens of servants with no embarrassment. For the most part, we are not even told their names. At times, both novelists mocked the pretensions and extravagant needs of their characters, as, for example, when Marion, who imagines herself in an elegant marriage with Willoughby, explains with a blush that, according to her calculations, it is difficult to live with less than £2,000 a year, more than 60 times the average income of the time. "I am sure I am not extravagant in my demands. A proper establishment of servants, a carriage, perhaps 2, and hunters cannot be supported on less." Eleanor cannot refrain from pointing out to her sister that she is being extravagant. Similarly, Vautrin himself observed that it took an income of 25,000 francs, more than 50 times the average, to live with a minimum of dignity. In particular, he insists, with an abundance of detail, on the cost of clothing, servants, and travel. No one tells him that he is exaggerating, but Vautrin is so cynical that readers are in no doubt. One finds a similarly unembarrassed recital of needs, with a similar notion of how much it takes to live comfortably, in Arthur Young's account of his travels. Notwithstanding the extravagance of some of their characters, these 19th-century novelists describe a world in which inequality was to a certain extent necessary. If there had not been a sufficiently wealthy minority, no one would have been able to worry about anything other than survival. This view of inequality deserves credit for not describing itself as meritocratic, if nothing else. In a sense, a minority was chosen to live on behalf of everyone else, but no one tried to pretend that this minority was more meritorious or virtuous than the rest. In this world, it was perfectly obvious, moreover, that without a fortune, it was impossible to live a dignified life. Having a diploma or skill might allow a person to produce, and therefore to earn, 5 or 10 times more than the average, but not much more than that. Modern meritocratic society, especially in the United States, is much harder on the losers because it seeks to justify domination on the grounds of justice, virtue, and merit, to say nothing of the insufficient productivity of those at the bottom. Meritocratic extremism in wealthy societies. It is interesting, moreover, to note that the most ardent meritocratic beliefs are often invoked to justify very large wage inequalities, which are said to be more justified than inequalities due to inheritance. From the time of Napoleon to World War I, France has had a small number of very well-paid and high-ranking civil servants, earning 50 to 100 times the average income of the day, starting with government ministers. This has always been justified, including by Napoleon himself, a scion of the minor Corsican nobility, by the idea that the most capable and talented individuals ought to be able to live on their salaries with as much dignity and elegance as the wealthiest heirs, a top-down response to Vautrin, as it were. As Adolphe Thiers remarked in the Chamber of Deputies in 1831, prefects should be able to occupy a rank equal to the notable citizens in the département they live in. In 1881, Paul Leroy-Beaulieu explained that the state went too far by raising only the lowest salaries. He vigorously defended the high civil servants of his day, most of whom received little more than 15,000 to 20,000 francs a year. These were figures that might seem enormous to the common man, but actually make it impossible to live with elegance or amass savings of any size. The most worrisome aspect of this defense of meritocracy is that one finds the same type of argument in the wealthiest societies, where Jane Austen's points about need and dignity make little sense. In the United States in recent years, one frequently has heard this type of justification for the stratospheric pay of supermanagers, 50 to 100 times average income, if not more. Proponents of such high pay argued that without it, only the heirs of large fortunes would be able to achieve true wealth, which would be unfair. In the end, therefore, the millions or tens of millions of dollars a year paid to supermanagers contribute to greater social justice. This kind of argument could well lay the groundwork for greater and more violent inequality in the future. The world to come may well combine the worst of two past worlds, both very large inequality of inherited wealth and very high wage inequalities justified in terms of merit and productivity. Claims with very little factual basis, as noted. Meritocratic extremism can thus lead to a race between supermanagers and rentiers, to the detriment of those who are neither. It also bears emphasizing that the role of meritocratic beliefs in justifying inequality in modern societies is evident not only at the top of the hierarchy, but lower down as well, as an explanation for the disparity between the lower and middle classes. In the late 1980s, Michel Lamont conducted several hundred in-depth interviews with representatives of the upper middle class in the United States and France, not only in large cities such as New York and Paris, but also in smaller cities such as Indianapolis and Clermont-Ferrand. She asked about their careers, how they saw their social identity and place in society, and what differentiated them from other social groups and categories. One of the main conclusions of her study was that in both countries, the educated elite placed primary emphasis on their personal merit and moral qualities, which they described using terms such as rigor, patience, work, effort, and so on, but also tolerance, kindness, etc. The heroes and heroines in the novels of Austen and Balzac would never have seen the need to compare their personal qualities to those of their servants, who go unmentioned in their texts. The Society of Petits Rentiers. The time has come to return to today's world, and more precisely, to France in the 2010s. According to my estimates, inheritance will represent about one quarter of total lifetime resources, from both inheritance and labor, for cohorts born in the 1970s and after. In terms of total amounts involved, inheritance has thus nearly regained the importance it had for 19th century cohorts, See PDF Figure 11.9. I should add that these predictions are based on the central scenario. If the alternative scenario turns out to be closer to the truth, lower growth, higher net return on capital, inheritance could represent a third, or even as much as four-tenths of the resources of 21st century cohorts. The fact that the total volume of inheritance has regained the same level as in the past does not mean that it plays the same social role, however. As noted, the very significant deconcentration of wealth, which has seen the top centile's share decrease by nearly two-thirds in a century from 60% in 1910 to 1920 to just over 20% today, and the emergence of a patrimonial middle class, imply that there are far fewer very large estates today than there were in the 19th century. Concretely, the dowries of 500,000 francs that Père Goriot and César Birotteau sought for their daughters, dowries that yielded an annual rent of 25,000 francs, or 50 times the average annual per capita income of 500 francs at that time, would be equivalent to an estate of 30 million euros today, with a yield in interest, dividends, and rents on the owner of 1.5 million euros a year, or 50 times the average per capita income of 30,000 euros. Inheritances of this magnitude do exist, as do considerably larger ones, but there are far fewer of them than in the 19th century, even though the total volume of wealth and inheritance has practically regained its previous high level. Furthermore, no contemporary novelist would fill her plots with estates valued at 30 million euros, as Balzac, Austen, and James did. Explicit monetary references vanished from literature after inflation blurred the meaning of the traditional numbers. But more than that, rentiers themselves vanished from literature as well, and the whole social representation of inequality changed as a result. In contemporary fiction, inequalities between social groups appear almost exclusively in the form of disparities with respect to work, wages, and skills. A society structured by the hierarchy of wealth has been replaced by a society whose structure depends almost entirely on the hierarchy of labor and human capital. It is striking, for example, that many recent American TV series feature heroes and heroines laden with degrees and high-level skills, whether to cure serious maladies, house, solve mysterious crimes, bones, or even to preside over the United States, West Wing. The writers apparently believe that it is best to have several doctorates or even a Nobel Prize. It is not unreasonable to interpret any number of such series as offering a hymn to a just inequality based on merit, education, and the social utility of elites. Still, certain more recent creations depict a more worrisome inequality based more clearly on vast wealth. Damages depicts unfeeling big businessmen who have stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from their workers and whose even more selfish spouses want to divorce their husbands without giving up the cash or the swimming pool. In season 3, inspired by the Madoff affair, the children of the crooked financier do everything they can to hold on to their father's assets, which are stashed in Antigua, in order to maintain their high standard of living. In Dirty Sexy Money, we see decadent young heirs and heiresses with little merit or virtue living shamelessly on family money. But these are the exceptions that prove the rule, and any character who lives on wealth accumulated in the past is normally depicted in a negative light, if not frankly denounced, whereas such a life is perfectly natural in Austen and Balzac, and necessary if there are to be any true feelings among the characters. This huge change in the social representation of inequality is in part justified, yet it rests on a number of misunderstandings. First, it is obvious that education plays a more important role today than in the 18th century. In a world where nearly everyone possesses some kind of degree and certain skills, it is not a good idea to go without. It is in everyone's interest to acquire some skill, even those who stand to inherit substantial wealth, especially since inheritance often comes too late from the standpoint of the heirs. However, it does not follow that society has become more meritocratic. In particular, it does not follow that the share of national income going to labor has actually increased. As noted, it has not, in any substantial amount. And it certainly does not follow that everyone has access to the same opportunities to acquire skills of every variety. Indeed, inequalities of training have to a large extent simply been translated upward, and there is no evidence that education has really increased intergenerational mobility. Nevertheless, the transmission of human capital is always more complicated than the transmission of financial capital or real estate. The heir must make some effort, and this has given rise to a widespread and partially justified faith in the idea that the end of inherited wealth has made for a more just society. The chief misunderstanding is, I think, the following. First, inheritance did not come to an end. The distribution of inherited capital has changed, which is something else entirely. In France today, there are certainly fewer very large estates. Estates of 30 million or even 5 or 10 million euros are less common than in the 19th century. But since the total volume of inherited wealth has almost regained its previous level, it follows that there are many more substantial and even fairly large inheritances, 200,000, 500,000, 1 million, or even 2 million euros. Such bequests, though much too small to allow the beneficiaries to give up all thought of a career and live on the interest, are nevertheless substantial amounts, especially when compared with what much of the population earns over the course of a working lifetime. In other words, we have moved from a society with a small number of very wealthy rentiers to one with a much larger number of less wealthy rentiers, a society of petit rentiers, if you will. The index that I think is most pertinent for representing this change is presented in PDF figure 11.11. It is the percentage of individuals in each cohort who inherit, as bequest or gift, amounts larger than the least well-paid 50% of the population earn in a lifetime. This amount changes over time. At present, the average annual wage of the bottom half of the income distribution is around 15,000 euros, or a total of 750,000 euros over the course of a 50-year career, including retirement. This is more or less what a life at minimum wage brings in. As the figure shows, in the 19th century, about 10% of a cohort inherited amounts greater than this. This proportion fell to barely more than 2% for cohorts born in 1910 to 1920, and 4 to 5% for cohorts born in 1930 to 1950. According to my estimates, the proportion has already risen to about 12% for cohorts born in 1970 to 1980, and may reach or exceed 15% for cohorts born in 2010 to 2020. In other words, nearly one-sixth of each cohort will receive an inheritance larger than the amount the bottom half of the population earns through labor in a lifetime. And this group largely coincides with the half of the population that inherits next to nothing. Of course, there is nothing to prevent the inheriting sixth from acquiring diplomas or working, and no doubt earning more through work than the bottom half of the income distribution. This is nevertheless a fairly disturbing form of inequality, which is in the process of attaining historically unprecedented heights. It is also more difficult to represent artistically or to correct politically, because it is a commonplace inequality opposing broad segments of the population rather than pitting a small elite against the rest of society. The rentier, enemy of democracy. Second, there is no guarantee that the distribution of inherited capital will not ultimately become as inegalitarian in the 21st century as it was in the 19th. As noted in the previous chapter, there is no ineluctable force standing in the way of a return to extreme concentration of wealth, as extreme as in the Belle Époque, especially if growth slows and the return on capital increases, which could happen, for example, if tax competition between nations heats up. If this were to happen, I believe that it would lead to significant political upheaval. Our democratic societies rest on a meritocratic worldview, or, at any rate, a meritocratic hope, by which I mean a belief in a society in which inequality is based more on merit and effort than on kinship and rents. This belief and this hope play a very crucial role in modern society, for a simple reason. In a democracy, the professed equality of rights of all citizens contrasts sharply with the very real inequality of living conditions. And in order to overcome this contradiction, it is vital to make sure that social inequalities derive from rational and universal principles rather than arbitrary contingencies. Inequalities must therefore be just and useful to all, at least in the realm of discourse, and as far as possible in reality as well. Social distinctions can be based only on common utility, according to Article 1 of the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. In 1893, Émile Durkheim predicted that modern democratic society would not put up for long with the existence of inherited wealth and would ultimately see to it that ownership of property ended at death. It is also significant that the words rent and rentier took on highly pejorative connotations in the 20th century. In this book, I use these words in their original descriptive sense, to denote the annual rents produced by a capital asset and the individuals who live on those rents. Today, the rents produced by an asset are nothing other than the income on capital, whether in the form of rent, interest, dividends, profits, royalties, or any other legal category of revenue, provided that such income is simply remuneration for ownership of the asset, independent of any labor. It was in this original sense that the words rent and rentier were used in the 18th and 19th centuries, for example in the novels of Balzac and Austen, at a time when the domination of wealth and its income at the top of the income hierarchy was acknowledged and accepted, at least among the elite. It is striking to observe that this original meaning largely disappeared as democratic and meritocratic values took hold. During the 20th century, the word rent became an insult, and a rather abusive one. This linguistic change can be observed everywhere. It is particularly interesting to note that the word rent is often used nowadays in a very different sense, to denote an imperfection in the market, as in monopoly rent, or more generally, to refer to any undue or unjustified income. At times, one almost has the impression that rent has become synonymous with economic ill. Rent is the enemy of modern rationality and must be eliminated root and branch by striving for ever purer and more perfect competition. A typical example of this use of the word can be seen in a recent interview that the president of the European Central Bank granted to several major European newspapers a few months after his nomination. When the journalists posed questions about his strategy for resolving Europe's problems, he offered this lapidary response: "We must fight against rents." No further details were offered. What the central banker had in mind, apparently, was lack of competition in the service sector. Taxi drivers, hairdressers, and the like were presumably making too much money. The problem posed by this use of the word rent is very simple. The fact that capital yields income, which in accordance with the original meaning of the word we refer to in this book as annual rent produced by capital, has absolutely nothing to do with the problem of imperfect competition or monopoly. If capital plays a useful role in the process of production, it is natural that it should be paid. When growth is slow, it is almost inevitable that this return on capital is significantly higher than the growth rate, which automatically bestows outsized importance on inequalities of wealth accumulated in the past. This logical contradiction cannot be resolved by a dose of additional competition. Rent is not an imperfection in the market. It is rather the consequence of a pure and perfect market for capital, as economists understand it. A capital market in which each owner of capital, including the least capable of heirs, can obtain the highest possible yield on the most diversified portfolio that can be assembled in the national or global economy. To be sure, there is something astonishing about the notion that capital yields rent, or income that the owner of capital obtains without working. There is something in this notion that is an affront to common sense, and that has in fact perturbed any number of civilizations, which have responded in various ways, not always benign, ranging from the prohibition of usury to Soviet-style communism. Nevertheless, rent is a reality in any market economy where capital is privately owned. The fact that landed capital became industrial and financial capital and real estate left this deeper reality unchanged. Some people think that the logic of economic development has been to undermine the distinction between labor and capital. In fact, it is just the opposite. The growing sophistication of capital markets and financial intermediation tends to separate owners from managers more and more, and thus to sharpen the distinction between pure capital income and labor income. Economic and technological rationality at times has nothing to do with democratic rationality. The former stems from the Enlightenment, and people have all too commonly assumed that the latter would somehow naturally derive from it, as if by magic. But real democracy and social justice require specific institutions of their own, not just those of the market, and not just parliaments and other formal democratic institutions. To recapitulate, the fundamental force for divergence, which I have emphasized throughout this book, can be summed up in the inequality R is greater than G, which has nothing to do with market imperfections, and will not disappear as markets become freer and more competitive. The idea that unrestricted competition will put an end to inheritance and move toward a more meritocratic world is a dangerous illusion. The advent of universal suffrage and the end of property qualifications for voting, which in the 19th century limited the right to vote to people meeting a minimum wealth requirement, typically the wealthiest 1 or 2% in France and Britain in 1820 to 1840, or about the same percentage of the population as was subject to the wealth tax in France in 2000 to 2010, ended the legal domination of politics by the wealthy. But it did not abolish the economic forces capable of producing a society of rentiers. The return of inherited wealth, a European or global phenomenon. Can our results concerning the return of inherited wealth in France be extended to other countries? In view of the limitations of the available data, it is unfortunately impossible to give a precise answer to this question. There are apparently no other countries with estate records as rich and comprehensive as the French data. Nevertheless, a number of points seem to be well established. First, the imperfect data collected to date for other European countries, especially Germany and Britain, suggest that the U-shaped curve of inheritance flows in France in the 20th century actually reflects the reality everywhere in Europe. See PDF figure 11.12. In Germany, in particular, available estimates, unfortunately based on a limited number of years, suggest that inheritance flows collapsed even further than in France, following the shocks of 1914 to 1945, from about 16% of national income in 1910 to just 2% in 1960. Since then, they have risen sharply and steadily, with an acceleration in 1980 to 1990, until in 2000 to 2010, they attained a level of 10 to 11% of national income. This is lower than in France, where the figure for 2010 was about 15% of national income. But since Germany started from a lower point in 1950 to 1960, the rebound of inheritance flows has actually been stronger there. In addition, the current difference between flows in France and Germany is entirely due to the difference in the capital income ratio, beta, presented in Part 2. If total private wealth in Germany were to rise to the same level as in France, The inheritance flows would also equalize, all other things being equal. It is also interesting to note that the strong rebound of inheritance flows in Germany is largely due to a very sharp increase in gifts, just as in France. The annual volume of gifts recorded by the German authorities represented the equivalent of 10 to 20% of the total amount of inheritances before 1970 to 1980. Thereafter, it rose gradually to about 60% in 2000 to 2010. Finally, the smaller inheritance flow in Germany in 1910 was largely a result of more rapid demographic growth north of the Rhine at that time. The M effect, as it were. By the same token, because German demographic growth today is stagnant, it is possible that inheritance flows there will exceed those in France in the decades to come. Other European countries affected by demographic decline and a falling birth rate, such as Italy and Spain, should obey a similar logic, although we unfortunately have no reliable historical data on inheritance flows in these two cases. As for Britain, inheritance flows there at the turn of the 20th century were approximately the same as in France, 20 to 25% of national income. The inheritance flow did not fall as far as in France or Germany after the two world wars, and this seems consistent with the fact that the stock of private wealth was less violently affected, the beta effect, and that wealth accumulation was not set back as far, mu effect. The annual inheritance and gift flow fell to about 8% of national income in 1950 to 1960. And to 6% in 1970 to 1980. The rebound since the 1980s has been significant, but not as strong as in France or Germany, according to the available data. The inheritance flow in Britain in 2000 to 2010 was just over 8% of national income. In the abstract, several explanations are possible. The lower British inheritance flow might be due to the fact that a larger share of private wealth is held in pension funds and is therefore not transmissible to descendants. This can only be a small part of the explanation, however, because pension funds account for only 15 to 20% of the British private capital stock. Furthermore, it is by no means certain that life cycle wealth is supplanting transmissible wealth. Logically speaking, the two types of wealth should be added together, so that a country that relies more on pension funds to finance its retirements should be able to accumulate a larger total stock of private wealth and perhaps to invest part of this in other countries. It is also possible that the lower inheritance flow in Britain is due to different psychological attitudes towards savings and familial gifts and bequests. Before reaching that conclusion, however, it is important to note that the difference observed in 2000 to 2010 can be explained entirely by a lower level of gift-giving in Britain, where gifts have remained stable at about 10% of the total amount of inheritances since 1970 to 1980, whereas gift-giving in France and Germany increased to 60 to 80% of the total. Given the difficulty of recording gifts and correcting for different national practices, the gap seems somewhat suspect, and it cannot be ruled out that it is due, at least in part, to an underestimation of gift-giving in Britain. In the current state of the data, it is unfortunately impossible to say with certainty whether the smaller rebound of inheritance flows in Britain reflects an actual difference in behavior. Britons with means consume more of their wealth and pass on less to their children than their French and German counterparts, or a purely statistical bias. If we applied the same gift-inheritance ratio that we observe in France and Germany, the British inheritance flow in 2000 to 2010 would be on the order of 15% of national income, as in France. The available inheritance sources for the United States pose even more difficult problems. The federal estate tax, created in 1916, has never applied to more than a small minority of estates, generally less than 2%, and the requirements for declaring gifts are also fairly limited, so that the statistical data derived from this tax leave much to be desired. It is unfortunately impossible to make up for this lack by relying on other sources. In particular, bequests and gifts are notoriously underestimated in surveys conducted by national statistical bureaus. This leaves major gaps in our knowledge, which all too many studies based on such surveys forget. In France, for example, we find that gifts and bequests declared in the surveys represent barely half the flow observed in the fiscal data, which is only a lower bound on the actual flow, since exempt assets, such as life insurance contracts, are omitted. Clearly, the individuals surveyed tend to forget to declare what they actually received and to present the history of their fortunes in the most favorable light, which is in itself an interesting fact about how inheritance is seen in modern society. In many countries, including the United States, it is unfortunately impossible to compare the survey data with fiscal records. But there is no reason to believe that the underestimation by survey participants is any smaller than in France, especially since the public perception of inherited wealth is at least as negative in the United States. In any case, the unreliability of the U.S. sources makes it very difficult to study the historical evolution of inheritance flows in the United States with any precision. This partly explains the intensity of the controversy that erupted in the 1980s over two diametrically opposed economic theories, Modigliani's life cycle theory, and with it the idea that inherited wealth accounts for only 20-30% of total U.S. capital, and the Kotlikoff-Summers thesis, according to which inherited wealth accounts for 70-80% of total capital. I was a young student when I discovered this work in the 1990s, and the controversy stunned me. How could such a dramatic disagreement exist among serious economists? Note, first of all, that both sides in the dispute relied on rather poor quality data from the late 1960s and early 1970s. If we re-examine their estimates in light of the data available today, it seems that the truth lies somewhere between the two positions, but significantly closer to Kotlikoff-Summers than Modigliani. Inherited wealth probably accounted for at least 50-60% of total private capital in the United States in 1970-1980. More generally, if one tries to estimate for the United States the evolution of the share of inherited wealth over the course of the 20th century, as we did for France in PDF figure 11.7, on the basis of much more complete data, it seems that the U-shaped curve was less pronounced in the United States and that the share of inherited wealth was somewhat smaller than in France at both the turn of the 20th century and the turn of the 21st, and slightly larger in 1950-1970. The main reason for this is the higher rate of demographic growth in the United States, which implies a smaller capital income ratio, beta effect, and a less pronounced aging of wealth, M and mu effects. The difference should not be exaggerated, however. Inheritance also plays an important role in the United States. Above all, it once again bears emphasizing that this difference between Europe and the United States has little to do a priori with eternal cultural differences. It seems to be explained mainly by differences in demographic structure and population growth. If population growth in the United States someday decreases, as long-term forecasts suggest it will, then inherited wealth will probably rebound as strongly there as in Europe. As for the poor and emerging countries, we unfortunately lack reliable historical sources concerning inherited wealth and its evolution. It seems plausible that if demographic and economic growth ultimately decrease, as they are likely to do this century, then inherited wealth will acquire as much importance in most countries as it has had in low-growth countries throughout history. In countries that experience negative demographic growth, inherited wealth could even take on hitherto unprecedented importance. It is important to point out, however, that this will take time. With the rate of growth currently observed in emerging countries such as China, it seems clear that inheritance flows are, for the time, being quite limited. For working-age Chinese, who are currently experiencing income growth of 5 to 10% a year. Wealth in the vast majority of cases comes primarily from savings and not from grandparents, whose income was many times smaller. The global rebound of inherited wealth will no doubt be an important feature of the 21st century, but for some decades to come, it will affect mainly Europe and, to a lesser degree, the United States. Chapter 12. Global Inequality of Wealth in the 21st Century. I have thus far adopted a too narrowly national point of view concerning the dynamics of wealth inequality. To be sure, the crucial role of foreign assets owned by citizens of Britain and France in the 19th and early 20th centuries has been mentioned several times, but more needs to be said, because the question of international inequality of wealth concerns the future above all. Hence, I turn now to the dynamics of wealth inequality at the global level and to the principal forces at work today. Is there a danger that the forces of financial globalization will lead to an even greater concentration of capital in the future than ever before? Has this not perhaps already happened? To begin my examination of this question, I will look first at individual fortunes. Will the share of capital owned by the people listed by magazines as the richest in the world increase in the 21st century? Then I will ask about inequalities between countries. Will today's wealthy countries end up owned by petroleum exporting states, or China, or perhaps by their own billionaires? But before doing either of these things, I must discuss a hitherto neglected force, which will play an essential role in the analysis: unequal returns on capital. The inequality of returns on capital. Many economic models assume that the return on capital is the same for all owners, no matter how large or small their fortunes. This is far from certain, however. It is perfectly possible that wealthier people obtain higher average returns than less wealthy people. There are several reasons why this might be the case. The most obvious one is that a person with 10 million euros rather than 100,000, or 1 billion euros rather than 10 million, has greater means to employ wealth management consultants and financial advisors. If such intermediaries make it possible to identify better investments, on average, there may be economies of scale in portfolio management that give rise to higher average returns on larger portfolios. A second reason is that it is easier for an investor to take risks and to be patient if she has substantial reserves than if she owns next to nothing. For both of these reasons, and all signs are that the first is more important in practice than the second, it is quite plausible to think that if the average return on capital is 4%, wealthier people might get as much as 6 or 7%, whereas less wealthy individuals might have to make do with as little as 2 or 3%. Indeed, I will show in a moment that around the world, the largest fortunes, including inherited ones, have grown at very high rates in recent decades, on the order of 6 to 7% a year, significantly higher than the average growth rate of wealth. It is easy to see that such a mechanism